Where We Are Now. These are two books I read in the last year that I heartily recommend. Post-Truth, How Bullshit Conquered the World. This was published before the beginning of the Trump administration. So the situation is only rapidly deteriorating from there. And this is by James Garvey, which I also heartily recommend, called The Persuaders, which basically has its main theme the fact that public discourse has degenerated at this point in time to basically an exercise in social marketing. And I think one of the key components to this trend, there are actually people in this room. Greg, Jeff, this is looking at you. Persuasion research is one of the forces, I think, that the literature on attitudes and attitude change has contributed to the ascendancy of that perspective on how we deal with electorates and those kinds of issues, and I will return to that. But it was not always thus. This is a quote from the James Garvey book. In winter of 1780, something unexpected happened, an epidemic centered in the heart of the city with debating societies springing up around the Robin Hood at first, then fanning out all the way to what were then nearly London's border. Every neighborhood succumbed. People of every rank rubbed shoulders in the debating rooms. Every large venue in the city was given over to rational amusements, and every self-respecting Londoner had views about where to go for a good argument. The Robin Hood could now expect 600 attendees a night. As many as 1,200 wedged themselves in for a big event. And from a 1780s review of one of these events,
the person writing the review said, "Much pleased was I to observe so numerous an audience assembled for the laudable purpose of edifying each other
by a search after truth." So this is a Britain that's a far cry away from the world of Brexit means Brexit, and a public discourse that's descended into mere platitude. And we're probably in this room collectively an audience who would welcome the idea that it would be nice to return a little bit more to those times. But what I want to take seriously as a way of addressing this question of whether we can boost this, is why we would want to do that in the first place, other than that we might arbitrarily think this is a good idea. So why would we be better off if we boosted rational argument, this kind of argument aimed at truth in society? What actually is the relationship between rational argument and good decision or truth? In fact, this is just a question of it asking, what makes rational argument rational? Right? What norms do we have for evaluating argument quality? Like, these should be things that we have something more to say about than just I say that this is normative or I think rational is good. So that is the problem that I've actually spent much of the last 10 to 15 years working on, and most of the talk is going to be about answering this question of what makes rational argument rational and what norms we have for evaluating argument quality. And then I'll say something about why that's useful potentially for increasing this again in public debate. So for millennia, the bedrock of argument was logic. The unfortunate thing about logic, though, is that even though logic is tremendously powerful, it has very little to say about everyday informal argument. So you can reconstruct all of mathematics with just logic and set theory, or so I'm told, but its traction in the world of everyday argument is tiny. And that's nowhere more apparent than in something that I started to work on while I was still at Cardiff in the early 2000s, which are these so-called fallacies of argumentation. They're best illustrated by example. This is an example of a circular argument. God exists because the Bible says so, and the Bible is the word of God, which seems a rather poor reason for believing in the existence of God. Ghosts exist because nobody's proven that they don't. Seems a poorer reason for believing in the existence of ghosts. Slippery slope arguments: if we legalize gay marriage, next thing people want to marry their pets. This one comes courtesy of the American Family Research Institute. This is a real outfit. And the point I want to make with this is that these fallacies are actually things that happen in the world, right? This is not just a sort of esoteric philosophical pursuit. These are arguments in actual, naturally occurring discourse. So the key question in the context of the fallacies, there are about 20 to 25 in this catalogue, which starts with Aristotle and the Sophistical Refutations and the Seeing Historical Editions over time, is why are they actually bad, right? Intuitively, these seem like weak arguments, but what actually makes them bad? What explanatory things can we say about them? Historically, classical logic was this normative standard, the yardstick we took to evaluating arguments. And sadly, classical logic has nothing to say about most of the fallacies. You might, of course, then want to say, oh, well, that's why they're bad, because they're not deductively valid arguments. But circular arguments are deductively valid arguments. God exists because God exists is a deductively valid argument. So it's simply the case that these intuitive notions of strength that these fallacies are tapping into and classical logic just totally dissociate. And that's also apparent in the second main problem for fallacy research historically, is that many have exceptions that have the same logical structure but don't seem quite as bad, right? So ghosts exist because nobody's proven that they don't. Seems poor as an argument, but this drug is safe because no side effects have been observed in clinical trials. It's the kind of stuff you basically read on the little leaflet, you know, that comes with your medication, and you actually base your actions on that, and that seems kind of intuitively rational. So we need to capture the difference between these two arguments, and that crucially has to somehow attach to the content of what these arguments are about. So fortunately, there is a putatively normative framework out there that is about content, and that is probability theory. So probability theory, unlike logic, is an intentional calculus, because probabilities attach not to structural content words, such as logical argument does, but to the content of the statement. Right? The probability that you associate with a particular proposition is determined by what that proposition is actually about. So at this point you might say, probability, isn't that just percentages? What's that going to tell us about ghosts and God and all of that? No, in this context, probability is a way of representing subjective degrees of belief. That's the kind of premise of the Bayesian probabilistic framework. And there's a normative basis that centers around instrumental rationality claims, which I'm going to talk about in a moment. But I'm going to show you first how this actually works in practice. So, what does a probabilistic perspective on something like this argument from ignorance, the ghost example, actually tell you? The basic idea is extremely simple. Arguments consist of a conclusion and evidence for that conclusion. In this case, conclusion or claim is ghosts exist, right? And the evidence is that nobody's proven that ghosts don't exist. And the idea here simply is that a stronger argument, right, normatively, should be one that would lead you to change your beliefs more, all other things being equal. Right? So Bayes' rule is a rule that can be applied diachronically, that is across time, to changing your beliefs in light of new evidence. So all this is asking you to do is to imagine that you presently have a current belief in the existence of ghosts, and now imagine hypothetically somebody came along and told you this exciting new piece of evidence that nobody's proven that the ghosts don't exist. What Bayes' rule allows you to calculate is what your new degree of belief should be, your posterior probability in this claim, now that you've received this evidence. Right? And crucially, how far you should change your beliefs depends on these two quantities, on these two likelihoods. Right? These are the probability that you would observe this evidence, in this case, no proof that ghosts don't exist, if the conclusion or claim were true, and the probability that it would exist, that you would observe this, if the conclusion were false. This ratio between these two quantities is referred to as the likelihood ratio. It measures the diagnosticity of evidence, right? Because it asks you to consider not just how likely or reliably this evidence is associated with the truth of the hypothesis, but also how likely you would obtain it under an alternative scenario where the hypothesis were false. Right? So intuitively, if evidence is much more likely if something's true than if it's false, then observing it will increase your belief in the truth of that claim. If it's much less likely, it will decrease it. And if it's equally likely, then it's simply not diagnostic. It doesn't discriminate between the truth or false of these claims. It should have no impact on your belief. That's a very simple idea. So here's an example. It's from an actual experimental study. So imagine that you're an admissions tutor for a university mathematics department. You've received a UCAS application stating that James has reasonable GCSE grades, mostly B and C grades. To the actual experimental materials. How likely are you to accept James to read mathematics in your department? So you give a number, an estimate on 0 to 100. And then you're told, This application also includes a reference from his AS and A-level math teacher, who has taught him all his math throughout his AS and A-level courses. The entirety of the reference letter reads, James is always punctual and polite. And the question is now, are you...
I ask again, how likely it is that James will be accepted to this department? Are you now more or less likely to accept James? And presumably what's going through your head is, well, if James was good at maths, then in all likelihood, the maths tutor would be saying this, right? And I can't really think of reasons for if he were, why he wouldn't, right? So this seems like a diagnostic piece of information.
And you decrease your belief in James's mathematical aptitude, which is the phenomenon of being damned by faint praise. Now, this underlying likelihood that you've assessed,
right, you think it would likely, if he were good at maths, he'd tell you, and you don't see any real reason why he shouldn't tell you, if he were,
that likelihood depends critically on the nature of the source, right? And that's going to vary depending on whether it's James' maths tutor, who you believe to have knowledge about James' maths ability, versus, say, his personal tutor at his very expensive private school, who was his history teacher, who might know James personally, but know little about his mathematics abilities. So diagnosticity, right, the likelihood ratio, can change systematically as a function of all of these contextual factors, and with that, the silence on his mathematical ability changes just in the way that I've already outlined, right? When the likelihood ratio is positive, then your belief should increase, negative, decrease, and so on. So this actual experimental study, I said this is exactly where you find the blinding, the obvious that you expect, right? When the sentence James is punctual and polite is coming from his math teacher, this leads to a decrease, right? You think he's less good at maths than before, he's more now than it shouldn't be admitted. When it comes from the history tutor, there's no significant change here, right? It seems less diagnostic than evidence. And also there's this one extra condition where you were told that phrase that James is punctual, polite after, as a further step of information, after you'd been told something about his mathematics ability. And then being told that he's punctual and polite leads to a further increase, right? That just tells you that there's nothing intrinsically bad about being punctual and polite. It's literally the fact that nothing else is being said, right? If you were told something else, then you think it's a good thing. And you think, So far, so trivial, right? I've told you nothing that you couldn't have intuitively sort of done in terms of this experiment, though it did kind of help structure the study and what to look for. But the merit or worth of this kind of probabilistic framework is that it very rapidly takes you things that intuitively you probably wouldn't have seen. So in particular, once you have this treatment, an argument from ignorance, it becomes clear that there are very different types of argument from ignorance, which you might have thought were all the same. So the book is in the library because the library doesn't say it's on loan. It's structurally different from the medical test wasn't performed because there's no record in the file, which is different again from what we've just had. James is poor at math because all his reference letter says that he's punctual and polite. In fact, these all have a distinct logical structure and there are distinct versions of Bayes' theorem that apply to each of these. And as a consequence, they vary systematically in strength from each other when you consider them over the same world, over the same probability distribution or same set of facts. Now, to illustrate this, imagine a case of learning language. English, there's an argument from ignorance that plays a role in language learning, which is you have to figure out why certain constructions don't exist in your language, even though you just simply never hear them. So here are three arguments from ignorance that correspond structurally to the three examples I just gave you, but it makes it easier to see how they're distinct. You can say the dog big in English because my English book doesn't tell me that you can't. Right? You can't say the dog big in English because my English book doesn't say you can. Or you can't say the dog big in English because my English book does not mention this phrase at all. And if I apply this to that over a common set of probabilities, these three different arguments differ in argument strength as measured in that particular way, which is probably something you wouldn't have intuited, So this is just to kind of give you a flavor of the kind of work that we've been doing on providing a treatment of this catalog of fallacies. I would argue that we can do virtually all of these fallacies in the catalog in the same way. And there's a reason for that, which is that diagnosticity is basically a measure of informational relevance. And relevance is really, of relevance of reasons, is really the thing that makes arguments weak or strong. And irrelevant reasons really are things that make fallacious arguments fallacious. Again, I also want to stress, this moves you not just to capturing formally something that you already have intuitions about. It provides things that go beyond intuitions and often also things that conflict with your intuitions. So there's probably all kinds of things about circular arguments that I could tell you that you would find non-intuitive, but that having this formal framework gives you an answer. So the normative bite, as it were, is this, right? The theory of probabilities is at bottom nothing but common sense reduced to calculus. It enables us to appreciate with exactness that which accurate minds feel with a sort of instinct for which oftentimes they're unable to account. It's a famous quote by Laplace, right? The punchline really is that by having this formal framework, you can move on to cases. You not only get to say something explanatory about cases where this accords with your intuition, but you can move on to cases where you didn't have any intuitions, like three different types of argument from ignorance, or cases where your intuitions are virtually guaranteed to be wrong. And I can design cases. I can give you examples where your intuitions are just going to naturally be wrong. So, but that's the fallacies. Okay, we can do a little bit better than logic. There's a little larger framework of everyday reasoning that we can capture. But, you know, there's still a small catalog, 23, 25 categories. But for the same reason as you can do most of these fallacies, you can say something meaningful about a much larger fragment of everyday occurring argument. Because diagnosticity is a measure of informational relevance, and because argumentation is naturally about trying to change people's beliefs, right? So there's some fundamental fit about this framework and what argumentation is trying to do. And so there exists in the informal argument literature a catalog of putative argument schemes, where you can think of a scheme something as something like the argument from ignorance or a slippery slope argument. Those are all schemes. But these are now schemes that people think are good, not schemes that people have identified as being bad. And people have tried to collect in a sort of early scientific endeavor of sort of butterfly collecting and doing some systematizing types of schemes that pervade everyday informal argument. And they've tried to start to address the question of why particular ones of these schemes are justified. This is just a reference to a paper that looks at sort of three of these and tries to use these as examples to make a greater claim for what you can and cannot do with this catalog. And I'm just simply going to put that here as a promissory note. The idea here is one that I think is commensurate with exactly what that literature has wanted historically, namely a comprehensive treatment of informal argument that's computationally explicit and with a solid normative foundation that's useful in education. So the thing that I want to talk about next is this normative basis. I sort of at the beginning just said, well, there is a normative basis. But this is actually the really important bit to me and the important bit in the context of the talk. So what I said initially is that this Bayesian framework has a basis in instrumental rationality claims that are fleshed out with respect to decision-making and accuracy norms. I'm not going to tell you what that slightly cryptic and technical statement means. And we're going to start by thinking about the question of how good your weatherman is. Right? So historically, in the 1950s, meteorologists were concerned with this problem of trying to assess how good people were at predicting the weather. So the weatherman says there's an 80% chance of rain tomorrow, and then tomorrow it either does or does not rain. It would be nice to be able to score in some ways how good somebody is at making probabilistic forcasts. Breyer in 1950 put forward what we call the Breyer score, which is a very, very familiar error measure
to anybody who's a psychologist, because basically the square distance between the predicted and the true value. Now, you do this all the time, you probably never thought whether that's an interesting measure in any way, and you probably thought of squaring only to get rid of difficulties with respect to sign, but actually this measure has a number of important properties. So one of the properties has is that it's one of a class of so-called proper scoring rules, where a proper scoring rule is a rule that basically forces you to communicate your true estimates or your true beliefs. So imagine this weatherman is being assessed for accuracy, and there's penalties or rewards for being accurate. Right, then one of the questions that raises is whether the weatherman can ever be better off reporting beliefs other than his true beliefs about the probability of rain tomorrow. Right? It can maximize reward or minimize penalty in some other way. And if your error measure is a proper scoring rule, then that can't be the case. The weatherman will always strictly be best off with respect to rewards and penalties by just reporting the true probability. So you can't game that rule. And the other thing is you can decompose this rule mathematically, and you can see it rewards both resolution, that is how many different bins you provide. You just sort of say, rain likely, unlikely, or do you have more fine-grained prediction, right? And it rewards calibration. So calibration, we've already had some notion of calibration, which we thought wasn't exactly the same notion of calibration in Alexander's talk yesterday. So what do I mean by calibration? So to measure calibration, which is a correspondence measure between your subjective estimates and some objective reality, what you do is this. You collect all the propositions that you've assigned, say, probability 0.5 to, and you put them in a box. And then you look in that box, and you simply count the proportion of these that turn out to be true. And now you do that for all of the different probability bins that you use. Right? So you repeat this throughout the scale. And if you're calibrated, the labels to these bins correspond to the proportions of statements that are correct within that box. Right? If you're calibrated, then the propositions to which you assign a probability of 0.8 turn out 80% of the time to be correct when I look in that bin. Right? And so if you're calibrated on this line between objective and subjective estimates, you'll lie perfectly on the diagonal. If you're overconfident, you'll deviate like this. You'll overestimate high probabilities and underestimate low probabilities. Your judgments will be over-resolved. And if they were maximally resolved, you'd simply have the sort of step function that flips at 0.5, right? Where you sort of say, the moment something's just a teensy-weensy-weensy bit above 0.5, you say it's true, and below you say it's not true. And you might think, well, what's wrong with being over-resolved? As long as you jump to the right side, that seems kind of good because you're still tracking the truth of the world, right? But you don't want to do that, and you fundamentally don't want to do that because you want to make decisions in the world. And when you make decisions, many of the decisions you make are decisions under risk. That is, decisions where you're not simply choosing between two options that are presently on your table. So the lunch sandwich, do I want the ham and cheese, or do I want the egg and cress? Right? This decision concerns an outcome that I value, but that I have only a certain probability of attaining. Right? So I think I have a 0.3 chance of making more than X thousand pounds in profession Y if I choose that, versus a 0.7 probability of making this much if I choose that profession. So I have to weight those outcomes by the probabilities with which they occur. And if I'm overconfident, if I'm not calibrated, that weighting, that failure of calibration, will distort, in certain cases, the rank orders of options, which will mean that in the long run average, I'll get less of what I want. I will fail to maximize expected value. So that's why you want to be calibrated. But if you are calibrated, if you measure accuracy with the Breyer score, then you want to be Bayesian, because having your beliefs obey the probability calculus and updating in light of new evidence with Bayes' rule will minimize the inaccuracy of your beliefs across all possible worlds that you could entertain. When you measure that inaccuracy with the Breyer score, and saying that this minimizes inaccuracy across all possible worlds, it's just a fancy logician's way of saying, regardless of how the world actually turns out.
And finally, maximizing accuracy as measured by the Breyer score uniquely implies probabilism.
This is a special quantity. It's not that there's a zillion other frameworks that have this same property.
So, this is one line of justification, normative justification, for Bayesian reasoning.
There are others. The most famous one is actually for something different, which are Dutch book arguments, which tell you that, basically, if you don't assign subjective degrees of belief, probability is in line with the axioms of probability. For example, if you have a belief in an event and its negation, that sums to a number greater than one. Then if you engage in bets on the basis of those probabilities, you will engage in bets that you're guaranteed to lose. That's what a Dutch book is. And if you think that's a bad idea, then that's something you want to avoid. So what I'm spelling out here is that these are instrumental rationality claims. They're instrumental rationality claims in the sense that what I'm telling you is that if you want to minimize the inaccuracy of your belief, then you should be Bayesian. But I can't tell you whether you want to do that or not. Right? If you want to maximize expected value, then you want to be calibrated. But it's not for me to tell you whether you want to maximize expected value or not. Right? If you want to go through life making suboptimal decisions and be less happy as a result, that's still, at the end of the day, your choice, right? So it's a contingent claim. It's like, if you have goal X, then this is what you need to do to achieve goal X.
So, final bit of talk. How do we get back to public debate and rational discourse?
So this is, I'm going to spend the last few minutes talking about a project that I've been working on in the last 1.5 years, which is quite different from all of the things but connected deeply in spirit. So this is a website soon to launch, though I also said it was soon to launch in January, which tries to communicate standards or norms for rational argument to the public at large. So there's an outreach component. But at the same time, the way it's doing it is also a research project. So what forms the basis of this project is that we take newspaper opinion pieces and we try to provide an objective, critical analysis of these newspaper opinion pieces.
And so you see something like this, for example, an article in the Telegraph that was about whether sugar tax was a way of dealing with the obesity epidemic or not. And then there's a sort of critical analysis that's no more than one page. Now, from a research perspective, the challenge here is to see what can be said about sizable chunks of actual real-world text, right? These are actually published newspaper opinion pieces. Everything I've told you so far has been sort of individual schemes that might contribute to making up real-world argument, but this is just starting from the other end. Here's a piece of text. What can we say about it? So it'll tell us something about how prevalent and comprehensive these schemes are, but it will also give us information about what else is going on in real-world argument beyond these kinds of schemes that we need stories for. Fundamentally, the thing I want to stress is that what we're trying to do here is be not a party to debate, but a referee. Right? So I believe fundamentally, morally, intellectually, and along every other possible dimension I can list, that it would be a misuse of an academic who works on rational arguments to use a website like this to push what are effectively just my own personal views on a particular topic. And this will become important in the remainder, right? So we have to be really clear that we're separating out arguments that we might or might not personally find compelling that are in some sort of space of stuff where everything is created equal,
And things that you as a kind of an objective external bystander or a referee of sorts can rule out as bad. So you really have to try to conceptualize what those objective criteria can be about. And objective in the particular way that I'm pursuing this, and I think this is the only ground you actually have for objectivity in this context, and this is actually meshes with things I said before, is that this reduces to criteria that anyone with accuracy goals should in principle be able to subscribe to. And that is going to give you a central role for inconsistency. So just to give an example from the sugar tax example, the article on the sugar tax starts off by saying this: never mind that such a tax already exists, VAT. Most foods and drinks are exempt from VAT, but not sweets, chocolate, sports drinks, and soft drinks, so consumers already pay more for them. Never mind also that the impact of charging even more for such projects will be borne by the poorest. That's the opening line. The concluding line of the argument is this: human beings are shaped not only by what they eat, but also by what they do, and the decline in manufacturing and the rise in office work has contributed to expanding waistband. The best way for the British to beat the flat is to hit the gym. Now, I hope that you can see, on a moment's reflection, that those two statements are deeply inconsistent. Right? If somebody's too poor to afford the extra 3p on a can of Coke, right, they probably also don't have the 80 plus pounds a month that it costs to sign up to most gyms. But this is a very different type of inconsistency than logical contradiction or probabilistic incoherence. So it's a different type of inconsistency than what we've looked at so far. And I think the fundamental moral of this story is that as we broaden the range, the reach of normative objective criteria for evaluating argument, we move from logical contradictory inconsistency, which is a subset of probabilistic coherence, to an even wider set, which involves value or action inconsistencies and complex relationships between these. Right? So people in discourse can say things that they belie with their actions. And that, too, is a form of inconsistency that people can be called up on. So I think in the project of capturing ever broader sways of real-world arguments from a normative perspective, distinguishing between these types of inconsistency, and in particular enhancing formally our understanding of this type of inconsistency and combinations of various of these things, is fundamentally important. So, to wrap up, there are meaningful ways to measure argument quality, I think, and I just wanted to introduce you to those. I think there's a Bayesian treatment of the majority of fallacies provides explanation and tools for empirical study. I didn't explicitly say this, but all of those papers that I listed there, virtually all of them also have experimental programs that simply show that having a formal framework like this allows you to address experimental questions that you previously couldn't. I think this Bayesian treatment of argumentation scheme significantly expands the reach of normative theory, sorry, from classical logic, into a much broader realm of everyday argument. I think the quality criteria linked to considerations of instrumental rationality, that is, means to your end, not my end. And I think that inconsistency is the fundamental underlying notion that constrains objective evaluation. That's what's going on in logic, that's what's going on in Bayesian probability, and that has a much broader remit as yet to be fully explored. Our understanding of norms for real-world arguments is clearly an ongoing project, right? This is incomplete, I'm just showing you fragments and how I've been building this out over the years. But the thing I want you to see is the discernible shape of what a complete account would look like. And the thing I want to finish is my original question, and the question of why you in this audience should care. So the first thing I would like to point out is that this workshop is to a good extent about virtues and vices. And these virtues and vices, example in the context of argument, are derivative either, I think, of accuracy goals, right? Or they're set against them as somehow things that are being appealed to that go beyond accuracy goals. For both of those endeavors, you need to actually have a theory that captures the accuracy bit. Right? If you want to say arrogance is bad because arrogance is going to make you do whatever bad thing in the world, right? You need a clearly articulated role, clearly articulated theory of how arrogance and what you think about lack of calibration in the context of arrogance is going to do to your beliefs. And this is what this part of the theory is trying to do. The second thing I want to point out is that argument quality in persuasion research, as Greg and Jeff will also tell you, has long been identified as a key factor, right? It's one of the things that predicts whether people will be persuaded or not, is whether there's a strong argument there. But the problem is that persuasion researchers have historically not been able to measure this, right? So this has not been the main message with which they stormed out into the world, right? What they've stormed out into the world with is like lists and lists and lists of smaller, often smaller, mediating factors concerning peripheral routes to persuasion. That's why you have pens in the envelopes you get from charities, right? That's what they've studied, and they've studied that in part because they've had nothing to say about this. And that's part, actually, of where that imbalance comes from. I think that's part of why we've ended up in this social marketing world. And so if we have something different to say to people who do persuasion research, they also have a different message to take to people about how to change the views of the electorate. At the same time, if we want to change people's attitudes themselves about what kinds of messages they want to hear, we need to give them reasons for why they should care about rational argument. And of course, there's a massive asymmetry there, right? If I want to convince somebody else of a position, anything's fair game in a sense. And rational, right? Where the rational argument and the accuracy motivation really plays a role is if I'm the recipient. If politicians are telling me what's good, I don't want to be a mug. And if I have a theory that can spell out what the relationships are with things I care about, surely we're in a better position. And the final thing I want to end on is that I think really important here, and I tried to mention this in the context of the rational argument project, is that there's a fundamental intellectual virtue here, which is intellectual honesty. I think in any context where we tell people about what's rational or what's normative, we have to be completely precise about how far that goes and how far it doesn't go. And I think that's because one of the biggest problems that we presently face in the degenerate public discourse that we have is fundamentally to do with arrogance, and it's fundamentally to do with unwarranted claims. But we face that from both sides, right? One of the things, just read the book, excellent book by John Nichols on the death of expertise. And one of the things he's claiming is that one of the biggest problems we have at the moment is that it's subordinates, right, who are rejecting the voice of people who are experts. In the UK, this is all familiar to everybody. Painfully, under Michael Gove's, we've all had enough of experts. And one of the contributors to that have been the experts themselves, right? Experts who pronounce beyond their expertise and overplay their hand and claim to be able to say things and tell people what to do and tell people things are good that they have no real rationale for. And so with that little bit of soapboxy, preachy bit, I've got to the end, and sorry for slightly overrunning.